This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, initiating an oral history interview with Janice Carney. Today's date is the 24th of May, 2005. I am in the interview room of the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas, and I am speaking with Janice by telephone from your home in Florida. Is that right, Janice?
Yes, in Lago, Florida.
Good afternoon. How are you?
A little sick, so my voice is sounding raspy.
Okay, well, we'll work with that. Janice, I just want to confirm that you're aware this is an oral history interview for the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech, and that our intention here is to do the fullest possible interview with you about your life, your service to the country, that for historical purposes and research interest, we'll make the interview available publicly. Is that all right with you?
That's fine with me.
Okay, thanks, Janice. Let's start just by nailing down some basic biographical data. Where were you born, Janice, and when?
I was born on February 25th, 1950, in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family, the family in which you were born?
I was born in you would call it low class or middle class at its time.
Mm-hmm.
My father was just a common laborer. He was a World War II veteran. And bounced around from job to job and had a serious drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was roughly the middle child. I had four brothers and two sisters.
Wow.
And we moved roughly at least once a year during my years from birth on to say junior high.
Were you moving all around in the Boston, Cambridge area?
Yes, the whole metropolitan Boston area. I lived in Minnesota with Boston. I lived in the Columbia Point Housing Projects for a while, Phil's Corner in Dorchester, Charlestown, Somerville, just about everywhere.
Sounds like. Now, you mentioned that your father had served in World War II. Do you know anything about his service?
I learned more about his service after he died.
Mm-hmm. From your mom?
I did a research. I was working on a biography, which I hope to go back to someday, but I kind of got away from it.
Uh-huh.
And I got his discharge papers, which show where he actually served in World War II.
Which was where? Can you share that with us?
He started in Africa. He was in an engineering unit.
Uh-huh.
And he went from Africa to France to Germany.
How many years was he in the service, do you know?
I don't think it was either two to 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And the time frame really shows pretty much going through the wars in North Africa, which and then invasion into Normandy,
mm-hmm.
and then going into Germany. And it's an engineering unit, and just from my experience in Vietnam, I understand how they're ahead, actually, ahead of the fighting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I really related more to what he went through, and he was discharged as a private, which to me is saying something too. They was, after all that, if you discharge as a private, it's saying you're a little bit of a rabble rouser.
Something probably went on, huh?
Oh, obviously, after all that, leaving mm-hmm. with the same rank you got out of basic, growing up, he never talked much about World War II up until my senior year in high school,
mm-hmm.
when I hinted about my possibly going to Canada.
Okay.
And that was when we got into some really adamant arguments, especially after I graduated, over my issues of my sexuality and my gender and a lot of issues. And he was just so adamant about no son of his was not going to desert or go to Canada, and made it a whole issue of my manhood and
mm-hmm.
on everything that I was going to serve in the Army or the military. And that was the final. And even at that point, all he did was say, all I knew was that he served in World War II, and I really didn't know much about it.
Did you have brothers then that were older than you?
I had three older brothers.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest brother, they were all I had three older brothers, and they were all from different. This sounds like a good episode of Oprah Winfrey or something. But I had three older brothers who all had different fathers. My oldest brother was from a different father. That my mother never married him.
Mm-hmm.
And he, as soon as he turned 18, he left and joined the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the Air Force for several years. And the brother younger than him was also from a different father.
Mm-hmm.
When my father married my mother, she had the one child, and she was pregnant. And he got married just before he shipped off in the military. And that was my brother Jimmy. He never served in the service. He had a lot of he had a lot of issues. He was a pedophile, and I was one of his victims.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But he never served in the military. Then the next brother was my brother David, who was closest to my age.
Okay, right.
And he did the same thing. He quit high school at 18, and he joined the Army.
He went into the Army. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's he actually, he was in Germany. We were in roughly about the same time, and then he got out.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny. I was trying to avoid Vietnam, and he was trying to go to Vietnam.
I'm going to ask you about that later, because that is pretty interesting. So your relationship with David was a good one then? Or better?
He was the only, of course, you know, growing up, we were just about a year and a half apart.
Uh-huh.
About a year and a half, but two years and 20 days, actually,
mm-hmm.
apart. And he obviously didn't like me following around the big brother thing.
Yeah, right.
You know, when we were young, but when we were older, it was kind of like a more of a role reversal thing. That he looked up to me because I had, you know, served in Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting, uh-huh.
And it was kind of, and he always, he was the only one in my family that knew, you know, my gender issues.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he was always supportive and, you know, protective of me, you know, later in life. And he never told anybody. I think, you know, he was the first one, I think, to really know.
Was he a confidant of yours as well as things went, as time went on?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. We were as close. I don't think I've ever been that close to anybody.
Wow. Is David still with us, Janice?
No, he died from a brain aneurysm in his early 30s.
I'm sorry. When did that happen? In the 70s sometime?
The same year John Lennon died. It was a couple of weeks after.
Oh, mm-hmm. 1980, I guess.
Yeah, it was 80-something.
Mm-hmm.
It was right around, I think it was like a week after John Lennon died.
So right around Christmas.
Yeah.
Or just before Christmas.
Yeah.
Well, that's very sudden and very sad. Tell me a little bit about your sisters, if you can. You have one younger brother, then, I take it. And
I have two younger brothers.
Two, I'm sorry.
That,
uh-huh.
that are younger than me. Neither one of them didn't serve in the military.
Uh-huh.
I fear them.
Well, yeah, and their timing was also probably a little better than yours, if they were born in the early 1950s.
Yeah, my two younger brothers, because they obviously, they came into the age after the Vietnam War.
Right.
The time they were 18.
Right.
And it was all volunteer Army, so they didn't have, you know, the draft to worry about.
And they weren't drawn to that life?
No, I think if I spoke good of it, they might have been.
Mm-hmm.
Because both my older brother and my brother was in the Air Force, and my brother David,
mm-hmm.
they both never, you know, never knocked in the military. I mean, they described it as, you know, a lot of drinking, a lot of fun, a lot of sex and a great time. You got to see the world.
Mm-hmm.
Their experience was completely, you know, alien to my experience.
Right.
And,
So your younger brother's got a more complicated picture, probably, because
Yes,
of your experience.
Yes, I mean, especially the first, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I don't know, the first decade I was back, I was pretty much pretty messed up and hard to deal with. And then I get, my sisters are really years apart. I have a sister that's she's about, I don't know, 7 years older than me. I'm not sure exactly. That's my older sister. And she's the closest member with my family now. She's always calling me and we're always talking. And she's the most, probably the most accepted member of my family.
I see.
Since I've had Genevieve Simon surgery, she's been the most accepting. And my baby sister is just totally doesn't talk to me anymore. And as far as she's concerned, her brother is dead. I mean, really.
Does she say that to you?
Oh, yeah, pretty blatantly.
Wow. Well, tell me a little bit about yourself as a youngster. You know, you said things are clearly complicated. Your family's moving around, and there's a lot of kids. How did you cope, for example, feel about going to school? Was school a good place to go?
School was just I still start stuttering even remembering it. From as far back as I can remember, and this is part of why I was the biography I was trying to write. Part of what I did is I tried to trace all the different houses we lived in.
Yes.
And what an experience that was, driving all over Boston or taking the subway and empty lots with new buildings where there was once duplexes that we rented.
Oh, sure.
And it was kind of fascinating. And I got a list of all the addresses. And then from those addresses, and I got all my siblings' birth certificates.
Really?
Because my mind was really blank on so much stuff. I really blacked out a lot of things. And it was during this process with a lot of memories of being molested at a young age came back. And with the birth certificates, I got that sense where these eight of us, counting even the two before, my half-brothers.
Yes.
And in every single birth certificate, and it was like my mother was having a child roughly every 2 years to be a decade. At every single birth certificate, it was a different address where we lived.
Wow.
In a different area of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all but one, my brother... I think one of Jimmy and David, my father was listed as being in the military. And then the rest of us, it was all listed as unemployed. I think there was only one, I'm not sure when it was, there was only one where he had a job. And I was as a laborer.
Right.
But pretty much, he was listed as unemployed, and it was all these different addresses. And I tried to, using this information, I know I spent 3 years in the fourth grade.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Which is quite an achievement.
Yes.
I think
you're the only one I've ever heard of.
Yeah, me and Einstein.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, two. That's good.
I'm serious. He had a very similar, I read his biography.
Uh-huh.
And he had a very similar problem.
It's interesting. Uh-huh.
But he turned out to, okay, though, I guess.
He turned out all right, yeah.
We had just moved so much, and I was in and out of so many schools, and there was one period where I tried to trace all the different schools I was in the fourth grade, and that's where I kind of saw what my problem was. I was never in a school long enough to even make friends or even know anybody.
Were you in the public schools?
Yeah, it was Boston Public Schools, and I ended up being labeled retarded, which is the term they actually used.
Right.
and I had problems stuttering and bedwetting. And at the time, I was actually legally blind in one eye, and I didn't have glasses.
Did no one know? Did your parents know?
No, I mean, I just was...
You just thought that's the way everybody was?
Yeah, I just was totally lost in this middle where my mother, I mean, my father either was working some laboring job and coming home drunk.
Right.
And, you know, my mother was in and out of different affairs, and she was never around. And, so, you know, being in the middle, you know, of, you know, all these kids, it was almost like, you know, not a non-existence.
And you feel like you got lost in there?
Yes, I just was kind of, you know, during those ages, you know, pretty much through the first grade, straight on through, up until about the fifth grade, when I started just, you know, taking care of myself.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any adult who you felt you had access to during that time period?
Only when we lived in Charlestown, there was a librarian at the old Bunker Hill, Library, and used the Bunker Hill Boys Club.
Yes, uh-huh.
And those are the two places I used to go, especially the library. I would spend hours at the library.
You did?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
Reading.
What were you reading? Do you remember? What did you like?
When I was young, I really liked the Madeline books.
Uh-huh.
And as I got older, at a very early age, I was reading a lot of philosophy. I was in the seventh grade, and I was reading Nitsky.
Oh, God. I think you're probably closer to Einstein than to retarded. I'm just guessing.
It was really weird. I mean, I had this teacher and I was flunking everything and just really getting by. And the homeroom teacher was just seeing me. I was just constantly reading, going through these books, and I was reading a lot of Hermann Hesse and Nietzsche.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Probably scaring the hell out of the teacher.
But yet I was flunking everything.
Mm-hmm.
But that was when they started the different IQ tests and stuff, and they were seeing that, you know. And I got glasses by that time, too, which was a great help.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think I was in the fifth grade when I got my first pair of glasses.
Hmm. Tell me about the librarian that you mentioned.
Well, I'm not sure how old I was,
uh-huh.
but she used to bring me bowls of cereal.
Really?
Yeah, because you know I was spending a lot of time there and I wasn't eating.
That's very cool.
She was really a neat lady from what I can remember.
Sounds like it.
And she, you know, she never bothered me, and she let me stay there. I didn't want to go home. I had no friends. And
so you hung out at the library.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
You said that you started kind of managing for yourself a little bit more around about fifth grade or so. Did you then? Just to clarify, continue to move all through those years, the next years coming up, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade?
Well, what happened is somewhere around the 4th or 5th grade, when I was 12 or 13,
yes,
I started selling newspapers in Boston. And I was, you know, for that age and for, you know, I was doing pretty good with tips and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I always had a little bit of money. And I was going into Boston by myself after school. It would be right after school I would have to go, you know, into, and you stand on a corner by the subway stations.
Whereabouts do you remember? Which stations did you?
Right in the corner of, if you're familiar with Boston,
yes.
Right,
uh-huh.
in the corner of Washington and Summer Street.
Okay, uh-huh.
There was the old, the Boston Globe and the Boston Record American, as it was called then. And I really aged myself. They were like 7 cents each, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would give you a dime.
So you just hung on to the change?
Yeah.
Cool.
Just about everybody at that time.
Sure.
But when the paper got up to a dime, the tips went right down.
I'll bet. That was not good for your, your income.
Yeah, dinner wasn't worth it. And but after doing that, and then I got a job through the connections, and this is right in the corner of Washington and Summer Street,
mm-hmm.
where it goes out of the filing basement. So you just after school, what we did was try to get there, in time for them when all the businesses closed.
Right.
And you just had people swarming down to the subway that wanted the paper to read in the train.
So you just stand there and unload the newspapers and collect the dimes.
Yeah.
How did you get into it? How did you know you could do that? Do you remember?
My brother David had been doing it, and he's the one that got me the job.
Sure. Uh-huh. And you did that for what, a couple of years, or?
I was doing it when Kennedy was assassinated in '63.
Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, it was just an unbelievable day.
Tell me what you can about it, Janice.
In school, we did a set of announcements.
Mm-hmm.
That the president was shot, and he didn't say much, and didn't. They just dismissed shut the school down.
Wow.
And told us all to go home. This is Clarence Edwards Junior High in Charlestown.
Yes.
And I was just very big on JFK. I'd met him once.
Really?
Yes, because it's selling papers. Is what right in that downtown corner was where a lot of the politicians would come.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
I think it was when he was running for. I think it was running for senator.
So you had actually seen him?
Yeah.
Did you shake his hand?
Yeah. And I had really. I just really. He was. I remember very young reading Profiles in Courage.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back a lot of the stuff with my father. I was big on World War II, it being a good war, and those were my heroes.
Yeah.
And if Vietnam had been more black and white by the time I graduated high school in '69,
mm-hmm.
Even in spite of whatever other personal issues I had, I probably would have joined the military. But by the time I graduated in '69, Vietnam was just such a quagmire, and it was just so there was just so much going on, and I couldn't see any logical reason why the hell we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And but going back to that, after selling the newspapers, I had a friend. I got a job washing dish pans and dishes.
Mm-hmm.
She had like a little restaurant on Winter Street, and I did that for about a year. Then I got a job in Harvard Square in Cambridge.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And there was a supermarket there that's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in there. I was like a bag boy and all that kind of stuff. And it was neat because that was back in when the Club 47 days, where all the folkies played.
Yeah, and did you hang around to hear music as well?
Yes, I used to love to go over there because they got all their food and stuff, their coffee and all their stuff.
Yeah.
From our little market.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. So I got to deliver the stuff over there.
So
I could be over there in the afternoon with different people who were, practicing. And,
mm-hmm.
Dylan, Joan Baez, all these people.
Like, did you see Joan Baez there?
Yeah.
Who else? Do you remember?
Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was somebody, Tom Paxton, mm-hmm. Phil Oakes.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really hated, because they all would come in the afternoon, mm-hmm. To set up make sure the sound thing was set up, the mics and all that.
Right.
And so when they come in, obviously, at night. And it would be, in a much more just relaxed hanging out at your atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. This is sort of pre-superstardom for all these.
Yeah, they all were just the early Club 47 days when they all were just, and
And Club 47 was what, a couple of blocks from Harvard Square?
Yeah. It was in which street? It was on Church Street.
I'm trying to think.
These all the it was on one of those little side streets.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did also do during this time frame, going back to how I lived.
Sure.
I always had a part-time job, so I had, a little money for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved from, I think, Phil's Corner in Dorchester to Somerville.
To Summerill? Uh-huh.
Yeah, Summerill, Mass. I was in, I think the fifth grade. And I had already had, like I said, like 3 years in the fourth grade.
Yeah.
And they gave me a bunch of tests and stuff. Because it was the first time I was in the summer school system, which mm-hmm. was not part of the Boston.
Right, separate. Mm-hmm.
And Boston pretty much had just labeled me as retarded and had me in these slow classes,
mm-hmm.
which pretty much means, you know, you just sit in the back and either would teach you how to make an ashtray or something.
Yikes.
And it was the summer, they put me in the fifth grade, and they actually got me an eye exam, which my family never did.
Mm-hmm.
And they got me my first pair of glasses.
And you said that made a huge difference.
Oh, yeah, because I was always holding books, like, you know, real close. And I could only read a little bit, and I would get headaches.
Do you still have that deficiency in your one eye?
Yes, it's corrected with lenses.
Okay.
Which, you know, that goes back, you know, up until when I graduated high school and I went off for my draft physical. I don't get ahead, but I almost fainted when he told me I was 1A.
I'll bet you did.
Wait a minute.
Hey, wait a minute, yeah.
You know, I'm blind, I can't walk straight. What are you talking about? And, but after that year, they promoted me into the sixth grade, and my family moved back to Dorchester.
Mm.
And but by that time, my oldest sister was living in Somerville.
Mm-hmm.
She was married. Her husband was in the Marines.
Yeah.
And he was in he actually was in jail in Quantico, Virginia for desertion.
Was he?
Yeah, he did his own little world.
Hmm.
And so I talked to my sister and let me move in with her.
So you could be in that school district.
So I could stay in Somerville. I didn't want to go back to Dorchester.
Yeah, yeah, that was very smart. Are you the one who figured that out?
Yeah, there was no way I was going to go back to Boston Public Schools.
What did your sister say?
She said it was no problem.
Wow.
And she that she lived not too far from the. She was in that same school district, so he was staying in the same public, the school. And then I'm trying to think. First I lived with my grandmother for a while, because
mm-hmm.
my grandmother lived in Somerville.
So you managed to kind of patch together staying in
yeah.
Somerville schools.
Yeah, because then first I lived with my grandmother, then my family moved to Dorchester.
Right.
Then he came back, like about, I don't know, 7 or 8 months, and to another apartment in Somerville. And I moved back with him, so I could stay in the school.
Mm-hmm.
Then they moved to Charlestown. And so I did the fifth and sixth grade in Somerville,
mm-hmm.
and they moved to Charlestown, and I moved in with them, and I went to the I went to the Clarence Edwards, which was the junior high.
Okay.
And I just went there for about a week.
Yeah.
And I just was having just all kinds of troubles. It was just. A kid that remembered me from, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was always, you know, being picked on and stuff. But mm-hmm. at the time, I just was, I was just very feminine, even by this time.
Right.
The way I walked and the clothes I liked wearing.
Mm-hmm. And that just made you a natural target.
Yeah, I was very, very small and very skinny. And I couldn't deal with it. I think that's when I went back to either my sister's or my grandmother's. And I ended up going to, I went to my grandmother's, but I went to Northeastern Junior High for a couple of weeks, which was a real rough school.
Yeah.
And that was where my brother was like a year ahead of me.
Yeah.
He had gone to Northeastern, and he told me, that it was pretty rough to try to get in Southern Junior High. It's weird how it was, But I think that the Northeastern was where a lot of kids from the project went.
Mm-hmm.
And where the other junior high, Southern Junior High, was in an area where it was more residential.
Yeah.
And I think it's like that in any city. If you have a school that's got a lot of kids from a project, they just seem, or I don't want to, it's hard for me to sound classism, but.
That's okay.
It's what happens in these cities.
Yeah.
I ended up moving to my sister's who was in that district, and so I got into Southern Junior High.
Which one's Sutton?
Southern Junior High.
Oh, Southern, uh-huh, yeah.
Somerville.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that's when it really just kind of stayed together. I ended up, between staying with my sister and my family moving back to Somerville, I ended up staying for the 3 years at Southern Junior High,
mm-hmm.
and didn't go on to Somerville High. And so for those years, I was in the same school. And, you know, managed to make a few friends, but it was kids that knew me. I actually made the honor roll in the seventh grade.
There you go.
Which was pretty... It was that teacher, the home teacher I was telling you about earlier.
Yes, uh-huh.
He was just so fascinated with the books I was reading, and he couldn't understand. And he's the one that, I think I had one C and everything else was B and A's.
Hmm.
And he went to the teacher and he got that teacher to change it to a B. So it was the one quanta I was on the honor roll.
Hmm. Were your parents present enough to congratulate you and make a big deal out of you and say this is quite an accomplishment and so on, or no?
Not as much at this, but by the time I finished high school.
Yeah.
My father still had, his drinking problems, but he wasn't working. He was just so. By that time, the alcohol had just done so much of a number on him.
Yeah.
He had been in and out of the hospital with operations on his stomach.
Wow.
He had tuberculosis.
Uh-huh.
It was in a. He still drank, but he wasn't the angry, violent man.
Mm-hmm.
He just was just drinking into himself and wouldn't talk to people. Really. But I did really get this sense, for both my parents, that to have one of the kids graduate high school was important to them. And neither one of them had graduated high school.
That's interesting.
And up until me, all three of my older brothers and my older sister had all quit school as soon as they turned 18. About 17.
They had none of them completed high school?
No.
Wow. Hmm. Were both your parents born in the U.S. or no?
Yeah, they both of them. My father was born in Cambridge, Mass.
Uh-huh.
And a long history of his father and his father.
Okay.
Were born in Cambridge, Mass. And I'm not sure if it was the great grandfather or the great great grandfather was from Ireland.
Okay, sure.
But they settled in Cambridge, and there was a long lineage of John Joseph Carney, who I used to be.
Hmm. Janice, let me ask you about high school. How was it structured for you? Did you stay out in Somerville, or where did you go?
Through high school, I lived with my sister for a little while.
Uh-huh.
But most of it, by this time, my family had stayed in Somerville.
Mm-hmm.
They moved twice during the year. Nine was the middle school. From the 10th to the 12th grade,
right?
They moved twice, but they stayed in Somerville.
So it
didn't interfere because you only had one high school.
Oh, there was only one. Uh-huh.
Right, so it didn't. It interfered as far as, I think it was actually three times.
Gosh. The
project.
Wow.
The Mystic F. Housing Project.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think three times.
Now, how were you doing kind of socially in high school?
I had this kind of small little clique of friends that I hung out with.
Uh-huh.
And I dated the same girl from the seventh grade all the way through.
Uh-huh.
And we went to the prom and everything.
Uh-huh.
It's actually the only girl I dated from middle school to high school. And I had just a small clique of three or four friends that I hung out with at the same time.
Were these friends of yours, were they super smart people who didn't quite fit in, or were they kind of on the edge people, or how would you classify your little group? Or is it not? Maybe it doesn't lend itself to that.
Oh, they were pretty just kind of scraping by, average students.
Uh-huh.
And none of them played sports. Only one was kind of into sports, this kid named Paul Smith.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't really hang out with me that much, but he was just very, he kind of, I don't know, but adopted me. He is just kind of the Fonzie type.
Okay, right.
He played the guitar in the band,
mm-hmm.
and we just really looked up to. And he, I think it was in the seventh grade when kids were throwing eggs at me. He came over and just said something to a couple of them.
Really?
Yeah. And said it was my friend. And it was like, wow, nobody ever really bothered me again in junior high.
Hmm.
And
were you being threatened?
Yeah.
Like, is it, I mean, I get that you were, you know, taking the brunt of some bullying probably, but was it, did it go beyond that? Was it, were they actually threatening you?
They would bring eggs to school and throw eggs at me during the, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
That took some planning. I mean, they couldn't just, that wasn't like a spur of the moment thing.
No, I pretty much on a regular basis was targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, but that, you know, that kid had him, Paul Smith getting involved,
yeah,
really kind of changed things. When people saw me hanging out with him, and he, I'm not even sure really. He was just, I'm not even sure why, but he just seemed to, you know, take to me.
Sounds like he was a good young man. Who didn't want you roughed up or hurt, sounds like.
Yeah, that was really about it. And,
mm-hmm.
and he used to come over. He gave me guitar lessons for a while, but
yeah.
I kind of never.
That wasn't going to end up being your thing, huh?
No, I kind of. I wish I had kind of stuck with it, but
uh-huh.
I didn't have money for a guitar, and I kind of got into other things. But I'm thinking about now taking guitar lessons.
Are you? Good for you.
I would like to write some music to prove my poetry.
Your poetry, yeah.
But he, anyway, after that, he didn't even go up to the high school. And by the time I got up to high school, things just kind of quieted down, and I, for a little while, and he got more into just a couple incidents, because by that time, it was going into 67 and 68,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of the long hair and hippie, oh, yeah. stuff, and you, and it, the harassment was just more anybody, you know, with long hair was, you know, was called a faggot, and it was more generalized than personally. Than
I
personal.
See. I see.
And I, and I was just one. Real quick, I was one of the first people to jump on that hippie stuff.
You were.
Oh yeah, because that was cool. You can dress up like a girl and it. I mean, really, it was. Even Kate Bornstein. I don't know if you're familiar with her or not.
No.
She's another transgender person who wrote a book called Gender Outlaw.
Called Gender.
Gender Outlaw.
Oh, Gender Outlaw, uh-huh.
A fascinating book I highly recommend. But
okay.
She, in her book, she talks a little bit about that same time frame. And she has a very similar comment that kind of cracked me up.
That's interesting.
That's how she dealt with her, dealing with her gender during that time frame was a lot easier. You can run around with shoulder-length hair and beads and be to a certain degree feminine, and people just, you know, another one of them damn hippies.
Right. You kind of, there was a group that you could kind of be seen to be part of, even if whether you were or not.
Exactly.
Interesting. How aware were you of the war at that point? Were you just kind of vaguely aware that the United States was involved in Vietnam?
Well, no, because I was extremely aware.
Okay.
Let me think at what time. By this time, by the second year of high school, I was working in Harvard Square. Just working at Harvard Square in Cambridge.
Oh, sure.
With all the protests were going on.
I can imagine.
The big, every Sunday in the Cambridge Commons, there were these big peace rallies and rock Timothy Leary.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing Timothy Leary speak once.
You did?
What a space shot he was.
do you remember, what else can you say about it? Anything?
He definitely was experimenting with LSD too much and too long. Timothy Leary's all right by me, but he kind of, I think he lost touch of reality a lot earlier than people realized.
That was kind of his goal in a way, wasn't it?
he was still teaching at Harvard. I mean,
yep.
But he, but for the most part, there was such an aura of welcomeness and kindness that these, these Sundays, the people that were, everybody was stoned and against the war, but it was more, I think for the most part, the activism was just, nobody really knew anything. It was just a fun place to go on a Sunday. Listen to music, and I really think the most of the people really were clueless what was really, didn't even really care.
It was less about politics.
Yeah, more about a good place to get stoned and, meet girls or boys or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. And I still get confused with this. It goes freshman, sophomore, junior. Is that how it goes?
Yes.
I think it was in my sophomore, junior year. Most of my friends were girls.
Right.
That I had two or three real good, what I would call girlfriends. Not that I was dating, just girlfriends. That we used to have girl talk.
Right.
It was strange. But this one girl I was real close with, her boyfriend had graduated the year before. I was a couple years older, and he was in Vietnam.
Did she hear from him?
Yeah, she used to get letters, and she used to read them to me.
What did you make of that?
From that, I was already getting scared, because realizing that, for all practical purposes, I was male.
Right.
And I was, I was going to get caught up for a physical. Even 67, already in my mind, I was trying to realize that I might end up there and was trying to find out what was going on. And reading everything, that was available, newspapers and then 68, the Tet Offensive, and our we had already lost. I don't know what the figures were. We had already lost several class members that what should have been class of 69 kids that had dropped out. Then joined the military,
right,
and died in Vietnam.
Wow!
So by 69, we had already had several class members that had died in Vietnam, and some that had come back, and just weren't nowhere near the same person. So I was aware on that level. This is what made it for me just so calm. Complex is the word.
Right.
I had all these issues about my gender by that time that I was just holding and keeping secret. And there was just absolutely nothing masculine about me. I was 5'5", weighed about 110 pounds soaking wet,
mm-hmm.
had these big horn-rimmed glasses, and just couldn't, any attempt to, to try to do, sports was just a total disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought of me going into the military was just scary.
Right, and not just the military, but you're staring down the barrel of a full-fledged war. Being put in the middle of it.
Yeah, but by that time, there was just so much internalizing about who I was. And even in general, I was dating this girl that we never had sex, which was nice because it worked out well for both of us.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we all went to all the dances, and everybody thought, and
everybody thought you were a normal couple, steady, blah, blah. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And she ended up, she married, I don't know if she's married now, but she's been living with the same girl almost 30 years now.
Is that right?
Yeah, she lives up in Maine. She's been in the same relationship.
That's interesting.
She didn't come out of a couple of years after high school. But
are you in contact with her much?
I'm trying to think. I lost contact with her about 6 or 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about the time when I started transitioning.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think her girlfriend was jealous.
Oh boy, that's complicated.
Yeah. Well, she didn't mind it when when I was a guy.
Right. I'm just thinking that one through. Okay.
I really think something went on. I think her girlfriend was because she.
Probably.
I went from just being a male friend to possibly competition.
That's interesting. I'm sure that your intuition is correct.
Yeah.
That's probably what was going on.
Yeah. And,
that's unfortunate.
Ah,
because if you know somebody that long, it's.
No, it is, and if if they ever did break up, and because even if they, that's just kind of a. We all have our fantasies.
Okay, I'm with you. I am actually, Janice. Let me ask you a little bit about some timeline questions. You mentioned earlier that you, it was something of a blow to you. When John Kennedy was shot, and I wonder if you remember much about 1968, and did you have any feelings about, for example, Dr. King being shot or Robert Kennedy? Were those people who were in your kind of mind and in your life in some way?
Oh yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole 1968. I think anybody in my generation.
Mm-hmm.
But personally, it just seemed like the whole world was going crazy. It was just constantly something, and anything that seemed good, it seemed to get killed. And the stuff, and I, especially the racial stuff, because I for a while lived in a housing project in across the bay in South Boston, Sunday Point Housing Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I had Irish kids in South Boston throwing rocks at me, calling me nigger because I lived in a housing project.
Wow.
And the insanity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And Louis A. Hicks was such a screwball. And all what was going on in Charlestown, having lived in all these areas, I lived in Roxbury for a year by mm-hmm. Dudley Station, the most predominant black area.
Right. Yes.
1 year I went to a school where I think I was the only white kid in one class.
So did that make you more tuned in, do you think, to...
I think I had a really strong sense of the segregation in Boston.
Right. Because
even people were so much into denial.
Oh, yeah.
That you could see the huge difference between the black schools in Roxbury and Dorchester.
Mm-hmm.
And then go to the schools in Charlestown. They were better kept, more money was going into them. It was subtle, but even by 68, I had a sense of, segregation exists, and it does keep black people in lower schools, and it does keep them down. And it's not just the South, it's Boston, too.
Was there a reaction that you remember in any, wherever you were, in whichever part of town you were, when Dr. King was killed?
I got a sense that it didn't seem as important when it went out in Somerville, which Somerville was 99.5% white,
sure,
at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I really got a sense that it wasn't as, it didn't hit as hard as Robert Kennedy.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
I really did. But the other factor of it, though, by this time, and it's that offensive,
mm-hmm.
really turned the tide.
But what do you remember about that?
That
Jim?
The seeing that much, you know, fighting on the TV,
yeah,
and really seeing that things were not in that control. By that time, there was still a lot of thinking, oh, this is going to be straightened out in a year or two, the re-animization or whatever they were calling it.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, it was just like being hit by a brick. That's why I was just going to keep going on. It's so much more going on than we think, and we're not winning. And I don't know, was 68 too, when Johnson decided not to run?
Yes, right after the Tet Offensive.
That was the most vivid thing of that year.
You remember that speech?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That, still to this day, out of all this stuff, that look on his face when he made that announcement that he just didn't know what the hell to do, and I'm just not going to run. And that's pretty much what he said. He just had this tired look. And he just seemed to admit, I don't know what to do. And to me, that was the ultimate of even a president of the United States. He doesn't know the poll tubes out. He doesn't know where the poll tubes in. And he just given up.
Yeah. And then Robert Kennedy began to surface as a potential candidate at that point.
Right. And he
seemed to have an idea of what to do. Did you feel that way?
Oh, yeah. I had a sense that he had a much better shot at getting elected.
Mm-hmm.
He had some ideas. And it just seemed everything that was good was dying. It was going wrong. After he got shot,
do you remember where you were? That was in August, I think. Or, I'm sorry, June of 1968.
I just remember seeing it on TV, them showing him about to make after he made a speech, and he was kind of going to a kitchen thing.
Yes, uh-huh.
And you could just hear a shot being fired and people screaming. And I remember Rosie Greer being there, the football player.
Yes, uh-huh.
And it was just... even that age and being such a sensitive person, I remember crying and just being so, what's wrong with this country?
Right.
And I, and this is also when I went up and had my draft physical.
About that same time?
It was 68 because I graduated in 69.
Uh-huh.
And,
And you were 1A for the
trip. And I couldn't, I just totally, my father at that time was in a sanitarium for active tuberculosis.
Uh-huh.
And I was tested for tuberculosis and it came up positive.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. I was I was taking medication for tuberculosis and a letter from a doctor. I was legally blind in one eye without my glasses. Like I said, literally, 5'5", about 110 pounds of fat, and just absolutely no body hair at all, any facial hair or any body hair.
Mm-hmm.
I was just so feminine, and I just thought, sure, but something, there ain't no way.
What do you remember the physical? Do you remember that event? And what you went through?
It was, it was in Boston,
yep.
South Station,
uh-huh.
And I just remember hanging on to this letter from the doctor that I had tuberculosis.
Oh, I'll bet.
Like a piece of gold.
Yeah.
And, I had the medications that I was on, and I was just and all these, you know, just being, you know, we slip down to like a, you know, underwear boxes.
Right.
And just feel so out of place with all these guys in half naked.
Right.
And just not, and just so scared. So, that's not really, I just did not fit in any shape, way, or form.
To what do you attribute the fact that, that they raided you out of there ready to go?
That's kind of offensive. I mean, seriously.
Really, are you serious? You think that, that this is all politically and militarily motivated and had nothing to do with your health?
Yeah. I think after the Tet Offensive and the build-up, that everybody was winning.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just went nuts.
Gosh.
They were so convinced that everybody was faking this or faking that. And outside of, you know, the college deferments or getting into, the, you know, the guard units.
Right.
Anybody that, especially, you know, I'm sure that they thought I was putting on an act.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as, you know, my femininity.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought everybody, you know, was faking and trying to use stuff to get out. You know, in fact, today.
But
one of Phil's most famous songs, I draft Dodger Rag, you know.
Right. Right.
Got a purse, my ankles are whatever I'm wearing.
Exactly. Well, you were actually three deep, though, in reasons for them not to send you into a combat zone. Their own policies, and then you're positive for tuberculosis and being treated for it.
That's totally it. And I was hoping that I still kind of thought that they had kind of like a height thing.
And that didn't work out either. This is quite extraordinary.
None of it, because when I ended up in basic training,
uh-huh.
it was insane because they couldn't. The smallest size and everything was too big for me.
Because
they only make like small, medium, and large. You know,
right.
All the field jackets and everything.
Sure.
Which is why I'm saying about that they do have kind of a height and a weight requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought I was under the height. You know, I thought, I still think it's 5'6" and you got to be a certain weight.
So small, was the small clothes were just hanging on you?
Yeah, the smallest size issues of everything, even boots, everything was just too big for me.
Gosh.
But it was the, you know, as small as they had.
Well, let me ask a little bit about your thinking after you had been raided out of there, 1A. You mentioned earlier that you had some idea and that you had a confrontation with your dad about this, some idea that you might just go over the border.
Yes, this is going into, you know, 1969.
Right.
By pretty much, you know, my senior year, I knew, you know, I was just an average student. I actually could have graduated in 68 if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I was like one, I needed something like 2 credits. I was an average student, but I was ahead in everything.
Okay.
Because I took, I just took a lot of classes, and I passed everything, but all with C's, but I never flunked nothing.
So you were, in terms of credits, you were piling those up.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. I wasn't excelling in everything, in anything,
mm-hmm.
and everything was just easy. I mean, I didn't want to interfere with the what I was really reading.
Right.
And,
so you just blew through the classes.
Yeah. And I remember, I think it was in my junior year, they handed out like a list of required reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned back in and said, I've already read all that stuff. And I had already read every book on the list.
Was this like the 100 books you have to read to be an educated man or some list like
something
that?
Like that, the required reading,
okay.
You know, to get to high school.
Right.
It's a pretty standard, separate piece. And I don't think they've changed that. They may have changed it in the last 50 years, I don't know. But they pretty much have the same books.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, there was just no way that I was going to get any kind of scholarship. And we had no money for college. And the counselor, guidance counselor, or whatever, our advisors.
Right.
They pretty much told me that my senior year to take a business course and to take typing.
Mm-hmm.
And get real good at typing, and then join the Army. And he said, you know, chances are 100% that they'll just make you a clerk typist somewhere and you never see any combat. And I think that was pretty much what they told a lot of the young people at the time.
What did you think of that advice?
It actually sounded kind of good. and that's pretty much what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And, that my senior year to go business and typing and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, you know, the politics, it was a question of, did I even want to serve? And I got into a lot of things about, I tried to join VISTA,
mm-hmm.
which was the equivalent of the Peace Corps while you stay in the country.
Right.
And I had all the paperwork in and everything, and I went in to talk to one of their, I don't know, what do you call them, the council and everything.
Yeah.
And he pretty much called me and said I was trying to dodge the draft. And said he's not going to accept me, but he said if I do 3 years in the Army, then come back and want to join, he'll talk to me. Which was pretty weird. I still don't understand his logic.
I don't either.
I mean, if I want to join VISTA to avoid
what difference does it make?
Is that a bad concept?
Because
right. If I had got into the VISTA program, I think it was like a 2-year program.
Uh-huh.
And I would have gone somewhere in the Appalachians or somewhere in the country working with the Royal Poor for 2 years.
Right.
And that actually, would have got me through. That would have kept me out of the draft through, 69 and 70, probably even into 71.
Hmm.
But that didn't work. And then I tried filing for, that peace status?
Conscientious objector.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I tried that. That didn't work out too well.
What was required for that? Do you remember what you had to do? Did you have to interview with somebody?
Yeah, it was an interview. There's one question where they ask you if somebody... I forgot how to put it, but if I come up to you and punch you in the mouth, will you hit me back? And I said, of course. Never mind.
No.
Wrong answer.
Yeah. Next.
Oh, that's what I wish had, yeah.
Well, tell me about your high school graduation, if you can. At that time, did you feel pretty clear that you had exhausted the other avenues and were going to be drafted?
Yes. By the time it was 6 and 9 when I graduated,
right.
They were, a key thing was our high school, our senior class, the school wanted us to use the class funds to buy, they had two things they wanted us to buy, for the school,
mm-hmm.
A pollum, what do you call the thing that they speak on?
A podium?
A podium, yeah. There was a podium,
mm-hmm.
or some other thing. I forgot the other thing that they were hoping we would buy, because every class buys something.
Sure, right.
It's a tradition.
Yes.
We bought a tombstone, and he went nuts. We bought a tombstone that we wanted to put in the front of the high school with a list of our class that died in Vietnam.
Are you serious?
Yes. This was 1969.
And the principal or the powers that be were like, no?
Yeah, they tried everything in the world to stop it.
And what happened?
They couldn't. We voted on it, and the majority of the class wanted it. And it was our choice. They couldn't.
And did it get set up and put out in front?
Yeah, it got set up, and after about 6 months, it was gone. Somebody stole it.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was a pretty heavy thing.
Very. That whole episode sounds pretty heavy.
Yeah, I think pretty sure the school just didn't want it there and just kind of got rid of it.
Gosh.
But by that time... Going back to everything that happened at Tet and my experience with having a physical and just everything that we talked about with Kennedy and Martin being killed and
yep.
Gene McCarthy's campaign,
mm-hmm.
Just seemed completely insane and to go to Vietnam. And it was no, I mean, there was no question in my honest opinion by that time. It was just a class war. They were just all the poor kids, you know. It was all just the poor kids from the inner cities. You're fighting this war, and that's why nobody gave a shit. But even by the time I graduated high school, I had totally reached this point. And I weighed the options I had. It was either I was going to be drafted, or I could join and get into the medical corps, or go to Canada. And my grandmother wanted me to go to Canada.
Really?
Yeah, she had sisters. Going back to we were talking about my parents.
Yes.
I talked a little bit about my father.
Uh-huh.
My mother was born in Reading, Mass. But her mother was born in Nova Scotia, which is my grandmother.
Okay.
And she actually had sisters that owned a farm up there. And she wanted me to go up there and live with them.
Did you consider that?
Oh, I really did. And that's one of the things I mentioned to my father when about a month after I graduated. And that's when I got all his arguments that he was fed up at everything. And he just really exploded on me. The way I dress and the way I walk and everything.
And everything just kind of came together in one big outburst?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the next day, for about the third time in my life, I got rid of all my woman's clothes, donated them.
Mm-hmm.
I just totally psyched myself up that, no, I'm going to get over this. I'm a man, I know it, and I went out on a journey. But I joined. The compromise I made to myself was I joined getting into the medical corps.
How did you find out that you could do that? You could kind of, if you enlisted, you could, A, avoid the draft. Was this kind of well known?
Oh, it was really well known. If you wanted to avoid the pretty much even basic training, if you went into basic training, if you go in as a draft, there are two categories when you're drafted.
Right.
When you report in, and my brother had told me this, both my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You report to, my case was in the center itself, Boston. You will get an order on the day that, if you get a draft notice, you will get an order to report that day. And you don't even know what MOS they're going to give you. You only serve 2 years instead of three.
Right.
But you don't know what MOS, you don't know what branch of the service, they could put you in the Marines, Army, they could put you anywhere.
Right, but you have no control at all.
Right, and chances are pretty much 100% it's going to be combat.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And but if you join, you serve 3 years instead of two, and you can reach a contract agreement for a certain school, certain training.
Mm-hmm. So after this episode with your father, and you threw all of your clothes away, and you deciding what, that you were going to just go ahead and do this, and you had to do it, but you wanted to do it the smartest possible way.
Yes, I didn't want to get into combat or have to kill anybody.
Absolutely.
And that was the big thing with me. I wasn't afraid of dying, far from it. I really think I actually had a death wish more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if I got into the medical corps, even if I ended up as a field medic, you don't have to carry a weapon. It's your private option.
So you wouldn't be put in a position where you had to kill somebody.
Right.
Well,
I learned quickly, though, that just because you have a contract for the Army, there's a lot of loopholes.
Yeah, they moved you around, didn't they?
What happened, I ended up going, I had my basic training at Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too bad. The worst part of it was the cold. I had my basic training in New Jersey and January and February.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Sam Houston, where do you follow the obligation? And I had signed up to go to X-ray tech school. It was a 14-week, I think is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And if you complete that, then I would have been assigned as an X-ray technician. Then a couple of things happened. there's a lot going on. This was in San Antonio, Texas, and it was a lot of drugs and a lot of fun. But you had to pass this test once a week. At the end of each week, you had to read an X-ray and get it right,
mm-hmm.
and a written exam. I just got into trouble. I got arrested once for drinking.
Okay.
And the drinking age, I was drinking age in Texas is 21.
Yeah.
And I wasn't 21.
Mm-hmm.
They arrested. There was a whole bunch of us to be arrested.
This was in San Antonio? Or?
Yeah, it was mm-hmm. in some park. We were playing softball, without the softball.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And it was all park police and real rednecks. And
mm-hmm.
We were just lucky we were all in the military, otherwise they would have really. We're just pretty adamant the law is the law, even though you're good old boys and you're in the army and all that. But in Texas, drinking age is 21.
That's right.
You boys are men.
Yikes.
And so I had gone to a peace rally and signed as a petition against the war.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that.
I think that was a smart move.
Yeah.
It's still not a good idea at the time. But it was after I did that, I was halfway through the course, I think, and the Friday after I signed that petition,
mm-hmm.
there was a whole bunch of us. We were all like in different schools that were at that rally.
Right.
And we all flunked our test that week. And we all got real quick orders telling us out of the medical corps. And we all got reassigned to Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Well, before I ask you a little bit more about that, let me just go back to Fort Dix for a sec. And this would be basic training for you at the beginning of 1970. Janice, let me ask you about the atmosphere there at Fort Dix. You mentioned in some of the paperwork that you provided for us that there were some abuses going on there during basic training. Do you remember anything that you can share about those?
Yeah. And Fort Dix was really the country club of the Army. I mean, that was the easiest basic training you could get.
Why is that?
It was so close to New York. And it was just like a showcase.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
A lot more shit was going on in the bases down south.
Yeah.
A lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But still there was stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
What I was talking about a little bit, and I kind of got away from it, is when you reported in, you were classified as either a draftee or regular Army. And that stuck with you through your whole time you was in the service.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in basic training. And that was adamant from the minute you got to the center where you got your assignment. If you was a draftee, they just went, I don't know how many there were in a room, I don't know, maybe 70, 80, I'm not sure, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all just kind of lined up, and they were teaching us what attention means.
Right.
What shut the fuck up means. And, you know, a lot of little things that we had better pick up on fast.
Right.
And the first drill sergeant that came up, it was a DI.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing he said was, RAs, take one step backwards.
So that's regular Army.
Right, and I was classified as RA
because
I had joined. But right. he knew he couldn't touch us.
Okay.
But he had first pick of the draftees that were going to be assigned to the Corps. And that's pretty much what he did. He went up and down and just kind of said, you one step forward, you one step forward. And I don't remember how many he actually picked, but these guys are sweating bullets.
What did he make them do?
He informed them all that they were being drafted into the Marine Corps and they were going to Paris Island.
Oui. Uh-huh.
Which...
Yeah, you didn't want to hear that.
No, right. Nobody did.
Yep.
But I think a lot of them didn't even realize. I think a lot of them assumed that they got drafted meant they were going to go into the Army.
Right.
That they didn't realize. I mean, and did after that, the rest of us... I don't think they sent any into the Navy at that time. It was just... Or the Marines... In the Navy is the same, actually, technically.
Mm-hmm.
But but after that, the rest of us, we were just busted for dicks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, from that point on, from that we got there at night and all the running around and everything, just some different comments that the drill sergeants made.
Mm-hmm.
Right away, I got a sense that they were, you know, much more harsh on the draftees. That to a certain degree, they did have more respect for people that joined.
You mentioned that there was that there were a couple of people at boot camp with you who actually were eventually they were let go because they didn't make it in some way. You mentioned these are your words, a big, awkward, mentally slow trainee. Do you remember that? Do you remember him? Can you tell me what happened with him?
Yeah, there were actually two people that were draftees. One was this real tall kid that it was quite obvious he was lucky if he had about a sixth grade education.
Okay,
And there was another one that was this real, real 100% hillbilly.
Hillbilly, uh-huh.
Yeah, he was definitely from the back. He was from real backwoods Tennessee somewhere.
Sure.
And he did the same thing. I doubt if he had more than a fifth, sixth grade education.
Probably.
But how he ended up in is totally. But the thing with the big kid is he was just so big that they expected him to do things.
Uh-huh.
And he wouldn't do it. He was just so awkward. And he just couldn't do things in the physical stuff and the fighting. And it was kind of like, they were, and you know, both of these were draftees.
Right.
And I was just as bad. I mean, I think the three of us were probably the most likely not to make it to basic training.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't stay in step. I could barely make it over with the field stuff. You got to climb that wall and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I could barely just by the skin of my teeth do it.
Uh-huh.
But the hillbilly they did a blanket party on him one night.
And can you explain what you mean for somebody who doesn't know that reference?
Well, he pretty much were told that always. It's broken down when you go to basic into companies, and then it's been so long ago I even forget that. Then your companies, and then your platoon, and then your squad.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was at a platoon level. I think it was at a platoon level that we were about the worst. I mean, I was the only one that hadn't qualified one of them 16.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I ended up, I was the last one in the whole battalion. I just didn't qualify. I couldn't even hit the target. And, the guy called the hillbilly,
mm-hmm.
One night, we pretty much were told, the guy wouldn't shower.
Wow.
He didn't know how to make a bed. He had his uniform kind of rolled up in a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And everything looked, and he just couldn't pass an inspection. And he just obviously just did not care. And so we were pretty much told that if we don't do something about him, that something was going to be done to us. And I had nothing to do with it. Take my word for it.
Mm-hmm.
But one night, a bunch of guys went into his room when he was sleeping. And just what they do is the doctor just put a blanket over him and beat the crap out of him.
Right.
And he after that was taken to a hospital,
mm-hmm.
And I never heard from him again. I don't know what, I'm sure he got some kind of discharge. But it wasn't, nobody got punished for it or anything. That was what was so weird.
But it's almost like they sort of were baited into it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, you know, you got to find some way to get rid of him or we're going to flunk and then something's going to happen. Something bad is going to happen to all of us. And I mean, I'm putting in a much politer terminology.
Hmm.
And the other one, the real big the kid, is the drill sergeants were just constantly picking on him. And there was one weekend where they had this training, a lot of indoor training. It was a blizzard or something. And they did a lot of training in the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And this one drill sergeant was really, really ragging on him.
Kind of singled him out?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept on having him fight with the bungee sticks. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Can you describe them?
They're like a big stick with like boxing gloves on each end.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what they call them.
Uh-huh.
But you fight with them.
Okay, yep.
Then to who, you know, somebody is either knocked down or gives up.
Right.
And Adidas had this one kid fighting everybody.
Uh-huh.
And he kept on saying he's going to he beat somebody. And he just couldn't. I mean, anybody. And and at Joe's side, he just kept on hitting them. And I remember seeing his back the end of the night. He had this big red red mark of the Joe Sargent's call hand.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just crying. And the same thing. Somebody called the MPs on that, though.
Oh, yeah.
And they ended up taking him out with the MPs. And even the DI, after going into Monday, was gone, transferred.
Really?
Yeah. And it was kind of hushed up, but we got ready to riot after my company commander.
Uh-huh.
That if he ever found out who made the phone call.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean,
they were bullshit, because somebody called the MPs, and somebody called a congressman, and it ended up in a congressional investigation.
Do you know anything more about that investigation?
It went nowhere. All it meant is, you know, the person involved, some representative from their congress, you know, some aide or something, just came to the base and asked some questions. It's really rare that they go anywhere at that level.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But the message we got is, you know, whoever called the congressman, whoever called the MPs, you know, you were a traitor to your unit.
Wow.
That you were a scum of the earth.
How did you feel? I mean, just you yourself. I mean, you were already in a pretty vulnerable position, as you've described, with regard to these other guys. And how did you feel when you saw somebody being humiliated and hurt? I mean,
I just couldn't deal with it. I couldn't believe it was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just so isolated, and it was bringing back so much stuff from my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the names that they were calling me all the time, you know, I was, you know, almost convinced by the time I got out of basic training that my name was either Sissy or Faggot.
So you were getting emotionally abused as well, you yourself.
Oh yeah, you know, continually.
Others in the company also getting called those kind of names over and over and over and over, like you were, or?
Best I can remember, the three main misfits.
Yeah.
And I was the only one that actually ended up making it to basic, and that. Going back to what I was saying about how the other two were both draftees.
Right.
So I was regular Army, and I also requested training to go to the medical corps. And there were two things that the drill sergeants looked up to, and that's people that joined and weren't drafted, and field medics.
Is it too much to say that you kind of saved yourself by having enlisted?
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt in my mind that the abuse for me would have probably been much more physical. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I ever would have made it to basic training if I had been a draftee.
Janice, let me ask you a little more about the events at Fort Sam when you got down to Texas. You talked about going to the peace rally and stuff. Can you tell me how many guys went to that, and Was it just kind of for fun because it was a big outdoor happening, or was there more behind it in your own political thinking?
Well, I think mostly it was out of curiosity.
Okay.
You know, it was about a dozen of us that went, but roughly. And it was more out of curiosity and trying to... Those of us that still believe we had rights, even though we were in the Army, which, you know, they try to drill into you that you don't have those rights anymore.
Right, yep.
And I think we took more as a personal challenge for standing up to our rights.
You and how many other guys?
I think I don't know. I say at the most, a dozen. It may, uh-huh. 9 or 10.
Uh-huh.
And it was just like it just was weird. And the Friday after that, when I was told I'd funked my chest and I'd
yes.
packed it, they had a set of orders for me to get a bus ticket. And they literally sent me by bus from San Antonio, Texas to Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Just like that?
Yeah. And going from Sam Houston, San Antonio, to Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about arriving there in Louisiana.
They call Jim Houston the country club of the Army.
Uh-huh.
And they call Fort Polk the armpit of the Army.
Yeah.
Common terminology. But yeah, you get there and you're just going through miles of swampland.
Right.
When you get to the base, it's a small town, miles out. Lake Charles, not Lake Charles. Can't think of the name of the town. Lake Charles is further up. But it's just one real small, town. It's got a couple of bars and a couple of tattoo shops and that's it. And then you go for miles to swampland to get to Fort Polk, and it's just all these old World War One barracks, old wooden barracks
mm-hmm.
that were built during World War One as temporary housing.
Still there.
And I was shocked to find out that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading some article somewhere and saying they're still actually using it. There are troops in Iraq that have been trained there, and it's I mean. Temporary housing built for World War One, and the Army is still using them.
It's unbelievable.
And there were just these old wooden barracks, and it was just so hot. I mean, it was the closest they could actually probably get in this country to getting you ready for Vietnam as far as weather-wise.
Mm-hmm.
They got you used to all that humidity and the heat and mosquitoes.
What months were you down there then? May? Would that be?
May? I think it was something like May or June.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
July.
Hot.
Yeah, because I went home, June. Because I went home the end of June. I had like a week.
Right.
A week or two. It was right around that time frame. Because then July is when I reported out to Oakland to Vietnam.
And that week that you went home after finishing it, at Fort Polk, where I should just, for the record, confirm that you finally emerged with specialist training as what? Do you remember?
Well, I was trained. Technically, I had completed the field medic training.
You had,
in Fort Sam Houston, because that's, you got to do the field medic training before you go to any of the specialty schools.
Right, that's the prereq.
Right.
Right.
So I had the field medic training and half the X-ray tech. So technically, my MOS should have been field medic.
Mm-hmm.
But when he sent me to Fort Polk, he taught me, clerk typing, which I only knew anyway. Typing and filing,
mm-hmm.
which is, I mean, they're trying to teach these guys the alphabet, and for some of them, it was awful painful. It was sad, actually.
Were you actually relieved, though, that you had, because remember you had told us the high school counselor said, look, if you've got typing and filing, you're probably not going to see action.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was kind of, I mean, I was so nervous and pissed off at first. And, when he said he was going to Fort Polk, I didn't know what. When you do the tiger training and a lot of infantry training.
Right.
I don't know what. Technically, when he said I flunked the test, technically, as far as the contract goes, I broke the contract by not meeting the standards.
Mm-hmm.
That he could have done anything he wanted with me. I still had to stay the 3 years though, which I still that's still.
Well, that's rough.
Yeah, but the so when I got the Fort Polk, and these Japanese drill sergeants would have, they made the drill sergeants I had in up at Dix look like teddy bears. I mean, these guys are nasty. I mean, he was just brutal.
Can you tell me any instances that you remember?
Ah, once, I mean, it was just insane. I mean, as soon as they heard my Boston accent, it was like I was fighting, refighting the Civil War.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, we got a Yankee here. It was just so, you know, totally, and it, and it got to the same crap, or, you know, when the formations, you know, once again, the division, I was the shortest guy in the battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And you all line up by height, the weight company, and then it goes down the shortest guy. And it was the same crap. You know, I was at the end and just couldn't, you know, they'd step and just kind of skipping along whenever they had these field parade things. And the field sergeants would just go nuts.
You made them insane.
Oh, they just, what's wrong with you? You know, I'm just being me. I mean, I can laugh at it now, but I
right.
could never stay in step. I just skipped.
Right. But at the time, I mean, this was serious business. I mean, these guys were in your face, I'm
sure. Yeah, yeah.
Did they succeed in scaring the hell out of you, or?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean,
I can imagine.
and it got into the same thing, but when he got into the training during the day, you know, I don't know what this was. It was like a 3 or 4 week thing is all it was to get you a general, you know, clerk MOS.
Yes, right.
And when he saw right off the bat that I knew how to type and I know your basic filing system, you know, it goes a little bit beyond the alphabet, but I was being a little, you know, that, you know.
You could handle this. This was way within what you could do.
Yeah, they saw in day one. And, you
absolutely,
know,
yeah.
I was one of, I had a high school education with, at that time, most of the draftees didn't even have a high school education.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of, you know.
Again.
You know, they kind of getting laid off me. I was regular Army.
Right.
And, you know, I had some kind of a skill. So I didn't have all those headaches. I didn't, you know, they were going nuts with some of these people.
Well,
you know, trying to teach them to type.
Did you get, beyond the things that you've told us already, were you being targeted because people perceived you not only as not being able to do the marching and so forth, but as effeminate? I mean, were there specific things that were coming at you because of that?
Oh, yeah, totally. To all of it. I think all three, they were a lot more accepting at CM Houston because the medical corps has a lot of, a lot of gays and lesbians.
Yes.
They're much more tolerant.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, from Dixon, yeah, I was constantly getting it. I think they assumed that I was gay, more than, you know, they were clueless as far as transgender stuff.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
And, I was constantly getting it. And that's why I say, if I wasn't regular Army, if I hadn't joined, there's no way I ever would have made it through.
Did you pick up on other men, whether they were gay or had identity issues that may have paralleled some of yours? Did you pick up on those other guys that were around that may have been getting some of the same kind of, you know, attacks or abuse or headaches or whatever that you were getting? Did you see this happening to other people too?
Yes, kind of. I think it was common practice. I think it still is.
Mm-hmm.
That if you come across, you know, appearing, there's some people. People are born gay. I don't doubt in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That and same thing with, you know, transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
That it's the way you're born,
right.
And these characteristics,
mm-hmm.
that you just cannot. Some gay men can get so used into acting. And I'll call it acting,
okay.
Like your typical macho guy.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But you know, a good portion of gay men just have a way of talking and expressing themselves, and it's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones that you know, got picked on. And they, you know, there weren't that many, but we seemed, you know, could tell from each other.
Oh, sure.
And it was, that was one of the things that fascinated me, you know, about Sam Houston. It just seemed so many more open, and people that were, you know, permanent party there, so much more leniency. As soon as I got the poke, it was right back to,
mm-hmm.
you know, anybody that seemed a little swishy, or, you know, not quite up to that masculine, you know, automatically. It carries over to a lot of straight men. I won't say a lot, but a fair amount,
mm-hmm.
that are totally straight, but still they ain't all that masculine.
Right, right.
And then it gets into the, you know, assumption, or, you know, perception.
That's the interesting part, isn't it, that this is all kind of being judged, you know, the judge and jury are all out there operating on perceptions and no information.
Yeah. It goes even to the murder of that soldier in Kentucky a couple
mm-hmm,
years ago.
Mm-hmm, at Fort Campbell.
Yeah, and which mm-hmm. is, and that's my unit, 101st Airborne. That's why I ended up actually serving with.
Interesting.
That happened. And that was about perception. I know I'm kind of a map here, but that's the thing. The guy they killed, he was dating a transsexual. He was dating a woman.
Yes.
And she ended up actually, she's had surgery now.
Has she?
Yeah, she a couple years ago. She's, I can't think of her name. She actually belongs to Tava. She was a veteran, too. She served in the military.
I didn't know that she was a veteran, too.
Yeah, she was a veteran, and she was working, doing drag shows at
mm-hmm.
one of the clubs near the base when she met the soldier.
Right.
But she identified as transsexual, and she did end up, she's had complete surgery now.
Wow.
And,
let me just clarify that, what is TAVA, just for someone who doesn't know that?
TAVA is the Transgender American Veterans Association.
Right. And when was that actually organized, Janice? Do you know?
We're about 2 years old now.
A couple 2 years, okay.
Yeah.
Janice, let me just ask you about your departure from Fort Polk. And you said you had about a week or so that you went back up north?
I don't remember how much leave time I had,
mm-hmm.
but I went back.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember being back up at home, if you were? Do you remember that week of leave or whatever it was, a couple of weeks?
Yeah, it was a lot of drinking.
Uh-huh.
And I remember it was just kind of just so strange, and my mother was having a hard time dealing with it. That's when you really, you know, when you get orders, you're going to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and the whole thing, you know, you're watching the news and everything, and some of my friends were still telling me you should go to Canada and not go.
Right.
And right to the day I left, I actually ended up. Technically, I was AWOL one day.
What happened?
Well, it was when I got to San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
I had a change of habit.
But
when probably one of my closest friends ended up going to the airport with me. I know only my family went.
This is at Boston?
Yeah, when I went to Logan Airport to fly out to California.
Nobody in the family would go?
Uh-uh.
Were they too broken up, or were they hacked off at you, or what was it that was?
I don't really remember what all the circumstances were.
Yeah.
I just said, you know, goodbye, you know, at the apartment we were living at the time.
Yes.
And, you know, just shook my father's hand, and this friend of mine, we took the subway out
mm-hmm.
to Logan Airport from Boston, and it was just surreal, I think is the word.
had your dad kind of come around? I mean, by this time you've gone through boot camp, you've got an MOS.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he had a certain amount of pride. I mean, I had, you know, the dress green uniform on. I was private, you know.
Yes.
I was an E2, and in 6 months I had the same rank it took him 3 years to make. Kind of, I was just a
nomad. Well, what about your mom? How was she doing?
She was one of was real, real emotional.
Uh-huh, sure.
And really having a hard time dealing with it. And, you know, my two little brothers and my little sister, especially my little sister, was real emotional.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a break there.